and welcome to Crosstalk, where all things are considered. I'm Peter Lavelle. Mr. Biden goes to Kyiv. The U.S. president's unannounced trip can be interpreted in a number of ways. Is one of them an act of desperation to keep Washington's coalition of the willing together just before the anticipated Russian offensive? We will soon find out. Crosstalking Ukraine, I'm joined by my guest Garland Nixon in Washington. He's a political analyst. In New York, we have Vladimir Goldstein. He is the chair of the Department of Slavic Studies at Brown University. And in South Bend, we cross to Michael Desch. He is the Paki J. D. Professor of International Relations at the University of Notre Dame. All right, gentlemen, Crosstalk rules in effect. That means you can jump anytime you want, and I always appreciate it. Vladimir, let me go to you. Breaking news here. A short time ago, Vladimir Putin, addressing the nation, announced that Russia would be suspending negotiations for the START II treaty, which I think in total now, that is the end of arms control that the Soviet Union slash Russia had with the West. Arms control essentially is dead. I seriously doubt negotiations will return before the 2026 expiration date. This is a major decoupling. The decoupling is done. Would you say so, Vladimir?
Yes, I think Russia kept on sending the same message to the United States and the NATO that don't escalate, but it falls on the dead ears. So Russia go through one action, another action, and they sooner or later have to realize that, you know, indeed, you know, all this talk about nuclear war is not just talk. It can result. You know, the other day when Biden actually was visiting Kyiv, Zelensky said, if China enters the fray, it means a third world war. So in other words, this is like, you know, important escalation, and Putin sends a message, a very clear message, both to the domestic audience and the foreign audience, that this is serious, and we'll do the best we can to protect our country, which includes, you know, stop talking to the people who do not listen to us.
Exactly. Michael in South Bend, if I can go to you now. I mean, going back to this decoupling issue here, we have a battle of narratives. Putin has already given his address shortly. Joe Biden in Warsaw will give his address. I suppose it'll be pretty much a repetition of what he said the last time he was there. Outside of possible gaffes, which we can always expect here. But Michael, I mean, this really is a battle of narratives. This is a decoupling. The red lines have been drawn here, and Russia continues to show that it will react to what the West is doing. And it has to do it out of self-interest, obviously, but it's very serious, and it's getting pretty scary, I would say. Michael.
Yeah, no, I agree, although I think the pulling out of the START process is more symbolic than real in terms of its impact. I think the bigger thing that may be happening, in fact, is the decision of the Chinese to become more supportive of the Russians in this war. So the real decoupling is, you know, if China becomes, you know, throws its lot in even more fully with the Russians, that will harden the battle lines in a big way. Two other things. One is the question, of course, of really how solid the Atlantic Community front is on maintaining the war. Yep. I think that's an open question. Yep. The elephant in the room, though, is the global South, which has not bought into the Western narrative in terms of who's at fault and how this thing needs to be brought to an end. So there are a lot of deep divisions, and they seem to be hardening, for sure.
I absolutely agree with you, Garland. I think that is the exact reason why Biden went to Kyiv for his very short visit. I mean, it was a kind of a cross between a fundraising campaign and cheerleading, okay, trying to keep his coalition together, which is fraying at the ends, because the cost of this conflict to Europe. See, Europe Europe is the one that's being crushed the most here, obviously outside of Ukraine here. And Biden has to keep his flock in order. And so to go and it was a public relations stunt. They cleared it with the Russians in advance. But I mean, this is Biden's war, and he's thrown everything into it. That's what makes this so dangerous, because these neocons that are directing him, they're uncompromising. And at the same time, Russia is not going to compromise its security. This is where we are, Garland.
Yeah, I think it's also a reminder to everyone that the current conflict, that in the current conflict, that NATO is now really a bilateral group that is consists of the United States and the most extreme elements in the in Europe, which would be, you know, Poland and the Baltic states. I think that the elephant in the room, the blue whale in the phone booth, shall we say, is the Nord Stream attacks by the basically NATO as a whole on Germany. So I think Biden has, you know, again, bypassed and ignored Germany. He can't talk about Germany much now. There are major problems, and they're concerned as to how that's going to iron out in the long run. But I think the Western Europe, we can see some cracks in Western Europe. We can see some very significant anti-war rallies happening in Munich. So I think Biden's concerned, and he's working with those who are of like mind, Poland, which seem to be willing to, you know, readily sacrifice the lives and livelihoods of their citizens for the neocon project.
Yeah, I'm glad you brought up Nord Stream, because Vladimir, there's all this talk, you know, it's like on antiwar.com in responsible statecraft about how negotiations could start. I don't know where these people are, where their head is blowing up the Nord Stream pipelines here. I mean, how do you negotiate with people like that? I have no idea, Vladimir.
Yeah, I think the mention of neocon is very important. So I think, there is another term which describes American foreign policy is like woke imperialism. So it has a very unhealthy kind of combination of this neoliberals with their wokeism and neocons with their imperialism. And this is a very powerful group. However, you know, I read an interesting essay talking about the Seymour Hersh article about Northwest. Apparently, the fact that he got this information tells us that there is a split within United States establishment. Somebody in Washington is not happy about this woke empire and its overreach. So I think it's a very important kind of dimension which we're mentioning, not only within the NATO, but even without United States, establishment, because people, smart people in Pentagon and CIA, they probably understand that this is not in American interest. This is in the interest of this very strange group around State Department and Biden, hardcore sort of supporters, and it has to be stopped. But there are forces, I'm sure, normal regular people who sort of in the United States who still believe that business of America is business and not war. So I think that's the one who eventually will come to power, and Russia will negotiate with them.
Yeah. Well, I think my colleague has made a couple of very important points. First, the pro-war party is broader than just the old neoconservatives. I don't think I'd call the other part of it woke imperialists. I think I'd call them liberal imperialists. These are people who are deeply committed to the liberal world order.
Yep.
I think there's a lot of, sort of the liberal world order that I personally am attracted to. But I think the problem here is that, it creates a series of big blind spots that really, in my view, explain how we've gotten into this mess. Yesterday, Jake Sullivan had said at one point, I think, reflecting on the cause of the war, that NATO expansion had nothing to do with this. NATO's a defensive alliance made up of democracies, both of which are true. But, from the perspective of the other side, you could see how that would also be irrelevant. And so I think when the history of this mess is written in much the same way that the history of the Vietnam War was written years ago, our liberal blindness is going to be a big factor in how we ended up in the soup.
Yeah, well, Garland, you know, talking about the liberal world order, I mean, one of the things that's really come about since the advent of this conflict is the intense Russophobia. I mean, you know, you have in the pages of Foreign Affairs, you know, basically we have to break up Russia. We have to break it up. I mean, this is where they're coming from. This is where it's all about. And what makes this so pathetic is it has nothing to do with Ukraine, even though Ukrainians are being slaughtered, okay, for a war that NATO wanted. The history books will have to explain to me why the Ukrainians went along with this in the first place. Garland.
So I'll push back. I oppose the concept of the liberal world order for a couple of reasons, not the least of which being it's a fake. It is equivalently the idea of me walking up saying, I'm here to help you, and then hitting you over the head with a rock and stealing your wallet. That's what the liberal world order is, number one. Number two, it also implies a hierarchical cultural order in the world. It implies that the liberal order, the liberal way of seeing the world is somehow superior, and that other people, traditional cultures, maybe the Africans, the Middle Eastern Muslim cultures, et cetera, that they don't have a right to their culture and that they would be better off if they accepted ours. And I think all of those countries are looking at what is happening in the U.S. culture with shock and horror, saying we don't want any parts of that. Whether we agree or not, I believe that all cultures, that rather than a hierarchical culture, that the world should be more like a mosaic, where all cultures are viewed as part of a mosaic piece of art, which all of them.
Yeah, but Garland, wasn't that traditional liberalism? That's what it was. Okay.
Yeah, right. But this
I am a dyed-in-the-wool conservative. I don't want to become a liberal, okay? And I don't want to be forced to become a liberal, okay? And this is something that they believe they have to remake the world in their own image, in the image of Victoria Nuland. That's a scary thought. All right,
gentlemen, I'm going to jump in.
I got to go. I got to go to a short break. And after that short break, we'll continue our discussion on Ukraine. Stay with RT. Welcome back to Crosstalk, where all things are considered. I'm Peter LaBelle. To remind you, we're discussing Ukraine. Okay, let's go back to Michael and Salpin. The first part of the program went in a direction I didn't really expect, but I really like it because I like to talk about the social and philosophical angles of all of this here. You know, Michael, this is, you know, one of the reasons why the liberal West, the elites in the West, they hate Russia because Russia is a very conservative place. And that's something that they can't tolerate, and they don't like to have any kind of alternative model. Now, you don't have to be a conservative to appreciate Russia. But, I mean, this is something, some of the themes here. A lot of people don't understand until Netflix left the market. A lot of people would watch Netflix and kind of in an oddity, you know, like, wow, that's what they do in the West. We don't want that here, okay? But, you know, there's now a growing rejection of this wokest culture that is, and I agree with Vladimir, that's really infiltrated foreign policy. Your thoughts, Michael?
Well, I think the fact that a lot of Americans believe that Russia under Vladimir Putin was deeply supportive of Donald Trump, a quite polarizing.
Yeah, but there's no evidence of that. But nonetheless,
right. But nonetheless, a lot of people believe that. And so what it has done is, you know, made a domestic ideological fight in the United States internationalized. And of course, I'm old enough to remember the Cold War, when the Soviet Union was regarded as, you know, in the vanguard of the left. And now the irony is, for a lot of Americans, a lot of Americans on the left, especially, it's now a force of reaction from the right. So my head is spinning as things have changed dramatically during my lifetime.
Like the Washington Post never had anything bad to say about the Soviet Union, has nothing good to say about Russia today. My head is spinning too. Vladimir, you know, I guess we're all children of the Cold War here, and I knew a lot of great Soviet specialists, really, really good historians. They adored Russia. That's why they studied the Soviet Union. They hated communism, but they adored Russia and its culture and respected it here. That is another major change here. And you coming from letters yourself, that must be astounding for you teaching Dostoevsky. Go ahead, Vladimir.
Yeah, it's the whole thing is very, very, very crazy. All this former great, great professors. First of all, they took Russia seriously. They took it with respect. It was a different sort of, you know, kettle of fish. They went there, they studied, they admired. Maybe certain things would put them off, but it was like a unique continent which you go and study and explore. You know, like go to Australia and study their animals, which don't exist anymore. However, with the collapse of the Soviet Union, they made a very idiotic conclusion that it doesn't matter. You know, let's forget about Australia. Who cares about the unique flora and fauna? Let's forget about it. And that's being bombarded again and again. Russia is not a real serious country. The only thing they can do is aggression. The only thing they can do is violence. So let's split them. And now add to this mix is like total loonies and paranoid maniacs in Poland and Baltics who actually support this idea. So basically, rather than sort of taking things seriously, we live in a serious world. We're facing serious issues all over the thing. It becomes like, no, we know the truth, and Russia does matter, and we're harvesting now what we saw.
You know, Vladimir, I took the occasion a couple of weeks ago to reread Alexander Solzhenitsyn's famous commencement address.
Ah, yes.
Which I didn't really understand at the time where he was coming from. But from the context of 2023, it makes clear, the deep fault lines between traditional Russia, which he'd come to represent at that point, even well before the collapse of the Soviet Union, and the liberal, big L liberal West. And I wish I'd been smarter. I think I would be less confused by what happened.
Well, Michael just came up with a great topic for a future edition of Crosstalk, because that commencement speech is absolutely fascinating. And remember, Michael, after he made the speech, the liberal West turned their back on him. Remember that, okay?
They
didn't use the term, but they canceled him after that speech. Let me go to Garland right now. Moving on, Garland. You know, what has happened here, the West has turned this into an existential struggle, which didn't have to be for the West. For Russia, yes, because of security reasons. And that's what it's all about. Nobody in the West wants to talk about security. They want to talk about victory. If you continue to look at what the Russians have to say, we need to be able to live securely in Europe. And you're not allowing that to happen. That's why this conflict in Ukraine happened. They still do not want to talk about it that way. It's existential. But that is a craven choice, and it's a self-fulfilling prophecy. Yeah, now it is turning into it because you made it that way. Garland.
Well, it's existential for their narrative. And since the neocons, the neoliberal peak cloud, live in the narrative, it seems existential to them. For their narrative to die, tantamount to them to actually die, kind of like when a person in the movie The Matrix dies in The Matrix, they die in real life. That's the way they feel about their narrative being threatened. But let me add this too. I think, and this is an important statement I wanted to make. When we talk about conservatism, there's a conservatism, a conservatism that is not tied to left and right per se, and that's tied to tradition and stability. I've traveled extensively in South America, unabashed socialist, Marxist, Leninist, etc. But when it comes to conservatism from a perspective of how they live on a day-to-day basis, they're much more aligned with, say, a Russia than they are with the United States. Why? Because they're very much into their tradition, the indigenous people, etc., and they're very much believe in stability. So to say the liberals who eschew tradition and who create chaos and instability, first of all, I think they're redefining left as cultural issues as opposed to traditional left, which sees viewing the world through the context of the working class. So I think there is a some difference in definitions of what we mean by conservative values of tradition and stability.
I can just imagine our viewers all nodding their head and agreeing with you, because I do, and I think that our panel does too. Michael, you're the one that brought up the global South, which I call the global majority. During the Cold War, they did look to the Soviet Union as a friend, as an ally, because it was anti-West, anti-imperialist, but they still do now. But they look towards the Soviet Union not because of its communism, but because they were against oppression of the West. But now we have the end of the Cold War here. Now we have the global South again looking to Russia in the way that Garland just explained to us, traditional values. Michael.
And stability. Yeah, stability is important. Go ahead. Sorry.
Yeah, I think it's a combination of things. Certainly, as Garland says, as Joseph Schumpeter famously said about capitalism, it's a process of creative destruction. I think political liberalism also is a process of creative destruction, and what gets destroyed are often traditional values. And most people are uncomfortable with the destruction of traditional values. So to the extent that Russia seems like a proponent of a different way of political and social ordering, it's attractive. I think also, though, it's balance of power politics. If you think that the United States in the unipolar moment needs to be counterbalanced, Russia and China are probably two of the logical countries that you're going to look to for that counterbalancing. So it strikes me as being overdetermined, power and culture.
Yeah, well, Vladimir, let's address that here, because the Ukraine seems to be the epicenter of a new Cold War. And this is something, again, the neocons around Joe Biden seem to be prepared for. They've been able to cow and capture Europe to the point where Europe has lost its sovereignty, though they're fighting in Ukraine for Ukraine's sovereignty. I find that really odd. Oh, by the way, the American southern border is left unguarded. I mean, there's some very peculiar values floating around here, Vladimir. Go ahead.
There is unbelievable hypocrisy which we witness. You know, I like the concept which Garland introduced as mosaic. In the United States, which is, say, they tolerate mosaic in Canada. You know, the United States is an English-speaking country, and that's fine if Canadians want to have, you know, French and English and have their own kind of, you know, tradition and culture in Quebec, fine. What's happened in Ukraine out of the blue, rather than having this mosaic, they have Russian-speaking East, very culturally pro-Russian East. They have very, you know, culturally pro-Polish, you know, pro-Western West around Lviv and Ivano-Frankivsk. So this Ukraine more or less continue to exist on the principle of mosaic. However, the West, NATO and United States decided to use this moment to impose this West Ukrainian values. People, you know, very, very much agricultural, you know, culture upon very industrialized pro-Russian East. This is absolute hypocrisy. They don't do it in Belgium, insisting on some particular language. They don't do it in Canada. But Ukraine was a very interesting, important bone of contention where they agreed to throw all their values of respect for other cultures, for minorities, just for the sake of driving this kind of very strange message home. Keep Germany down, keep Russia out, yep. And, you know, put the Ukraine as a wedge between Russia and Europe. Right. But this is the unity which is there.
Okay, Michael, we got 40 seconds. Finish it off for us.
Well, I think the tragedy of the Ukraine war is ultimately going to be that many in the West thought that they were doing the Lord's work, but as we know, the road to hell is often paved with good intentions, and we're certainly seeing the road to hell in Ukraine today.
Yeah, as I've often pointed out on this program, the more the West helps Ukraine, the more Ukrainians die and the smaller the country comes. That's a great ally to have. It's really, truly remarkable. And I have no idea what future historians will make of it. That's all the time we have, gentlemen. I want to thank my guests in Washington, New York, and in South Bend. And I want to thank our viewers for watching us here at RT. See you next time. Remember, crosstalk rules.